And this is KPCW. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 and 63 degrees here in Old Town Park City. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. Good morning, Park City, Wasatch back. Boy, it's a mild start already to your Tuesday. We have high pressure in place and temperatures are really heating up throughout the day today. In fact, highs in the upper 80s with sunshine continuing, about 88 for Park City. Heber will be 94 for your high. Unfortunately, high pressure and the heat is what we're looking at towards the end of the week and even into the weekend before we start to see a little bit of cloud cover work in around the ridge. So more sunshine tomorrow, a high of 90, 95 expected on Thursday. Temperatures maintaining those mid-90s, so near record heat through the end of the week. By the weekend, we'll start to see partly cloudy conditions as, again, moisture wraps around a ridge that's going to be in place. It's shifting east, scooping up a little bit of monsoon moisture from the Gulf of Mexico. It'll provide maybe a 10 to 20% chance of an isolated shower or storm. It'll take the edge off the hottest temperatures after some mid-90s on Saturday. We'll drop on Sunday to 91 in Park City. Overnight lows still in the low 60s and 87, partly cloudy for the high on Monday. For Heber, temperatures soaring into the triple digits. We've got highs near 94 today, upper 90s tomorrow, and then we'll see 102 for the high. That's expected on Thursday, with Friday 101, 101 on Saturday. Temperatures back in the mid to upper 90s Sunday, Monday next week. And we'll throw in partly cloudy skies with a chance of a stray shower or thunderstorm Sunday into Monday next week for Heber as well. So hopefully you're ready for this heat wave because it's here.
Yeah. Leslie. Any relief with any monsoon on its way soon?
A little bit of cloud cover into early next week with a few showers, but really it's not looking super impressive just yet. So we're still waiting for some more moisture or a bigger storm.
Okay. Thank you. Coming up, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Shane Scott, taking a look at the agenda for Wednesday's County Council meeting. Bruce Johnson is the Aquatic Invasive Species Lieutenant for the Division of Wildlife Resources. We'll be talking about the thousands of boat inspections that were made throughout the state over the 4th of July holiday weekend searching for quagga mussels. And People's Health Clinic Assistant Medical Director Rochelle Flynn and Diabetes Program Director Maylin Sorensen talking about their long-standing connection to the organization. Taking a look at some local news now. As temperatures rise over the land and the landscape dries, a prescribed burn in the Uinta Mountains intensified over the weekend. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports that fire officials are keeping a close eye on it.
The Ponderosa prescribed burn project 10 miles east of Camas began in May. Smoke has been visible intermittently across the Camas Valley, most recently on Sunday, when Summit County issued a reminder not to report smoke to authorities. The county says the smoke column is a mile within the prescribed burn boundaries. Ken Verbonker is a deputy district ranger out of the Heber Camas office. He says Oregon-based wildland firefighters are monitoring the fire closely.
We're not putting them out, but they're just making sure that they're fenced off and that they are not going to move into any areas outside of the box that we have established.
Anytime rangers see a smoke column or their infrared technologies detect hotspots, the firefighters dig a fire break to keep them within burn boundaries. The Heber Camas Ranger District brought in a team from Oregon because they had the most availability. Verbonker says the firefighters have been assisting with the burn project for more than 2 weeks. He also says the last time they ignited the vegetation was June 12th. Until Sunday, the fire was mostly smoldering.
As the smoldering fire moves into an area that's more receptive to the fire, and then it'll kick up into some open flames. And that's what this group out of Oregon is. They're then working that for us and then ensure that it doesn't grow into a bigger spot than what's active there.
Summit County upped its fire danger from high to very high Monday, and the National Weather Service included parts of northern Utah in a red flag warning ahead of July 4th. But the Uinta Mountains haven't been included in any red flag or critical fire danger warnings yet this year. A report released by the Federal Government Accountability Office Monday shows the U.S. Forest Service's prescribed burns rarely grow out of control. From 2012 to 2021, 43 of 50,000 such fires escaped the prescribed boundaries. Five of those were in Utah. The most significant was 2018's Trail Mountain Fire east of Ephraim, which burned 18,000 acres more than planned. Earlier this summer, a prescribed burn near Beaver grew into the 5,000-acre Little Twist fire, which was 40% contained as of Monday. The Forest Service says prescribed burns are intended to ward off large fires, as well as to maintain and restore habitat. Since May, rangers in the Uintas have burned 2,600 acres with low-intensity fires. The only area currently closed to the public is the Shingle Creek Trail. The Ponderosa prescribed burn is so named because the area east of Camas is one of the only places in Utah with native ponderosa pine trees. Verbonker says that's why it's critical to help the tree stand flourish.
We're looking to reduce any thick understory from juniper, mountain brush, lodgepole pine, or dead and down, anything that's on the ground, to open up the ground so that those ponderosa seedlings have a better chance at growing.
Residents are reminded not to report prescribed burns to authorities. KPCW reports prescribed burn updates on air and online at kpcw.org. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Republic Services, a proud supporter of KPCW, reminds you that clean, dry, and empty plastic containers, cardboard, tin, and aluminum cans are accepted in your curbside recycling cart. Plastic bags of any kind should never be put in your cart. More information at summitcountyrecycles.org.
I had a dream last night. Rusting far below me, battered hulls and broken hearts.
Josh Ritter, American singer, songwriter, musician, and author known for his distinctive Americana style and narrative lyrics, on our stage July 11th through the 14th. For tickets and information, please visit us online at parkcityshows.com or by calling the box office at 855-745-SHOW. The Egyptian Theater is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
KPCW News Time now, 8:14. Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Summit County Council meets in closed session Wednesday for nearly 2 hours before opening the meeting at the County Courthouse in Colville at about 2:50 in the afternoon. On the phone with a preview of Wednesday's Summit County Council meeting, I have County Manager Shane Scott. Good morning, Shane.
Good morning, Leslie.
Hey,
how are you?
I'm doing great. So before we get to that, tell us what you're stuck in that traffic there on the frontage road.
I am. I was coming from the Silver Creek area and was forced off of Silver Summit Exit 2. Just like it's already a traffic concern there in the mornings between that and the construction. But so they forced everyone off the 40 there at Silver Summit Exit 2 and pushed us onto the feeder road there between Home Depot, and I'm sitting between Home Depot and 248. So it's going pretty slow, but and looks like it's backed up. There's no traffic, hardly any traffic southbound, and northbound's very backed up all the way from 80 down to this exit.
Yeah, so the photo that somebody sent in, it is a Summit County Sheriff's vehicle that looks like it was hit head-on by a truck. So was the truck traveling in the wrong direction? Do we know anything about
it? I actually didn't even know this, nope. I saw a blurb on my phone, but I was driving and I haven't even looked at it. So that's too bad to hear. I hope everybody's okay.
Okay. Let's see. So it seems like the council meeting a lot in closed session. Wednesday is about litigation, and I know that you're not privileged to tell us what, but does the county really have that much litigation happening?
Well, I would characterize it more as a couple of high-profile cases. Probably the majority of the time we're discussing strategy or next steps in some of the events that you also know have taken place. So it's just the probably more complicated one or two issues as opposed to many, many different litigation issues.
All right. Well, now that, and I don't know if people kind of realize this, but the county taxpayers are now paying for both the prosecution and the defense of Corey Richens in the murder trial. Do we have any idea what that's costing county taxpayers?
Well, we don't. We have some estimates, and we're going to address this significantly in the fiscal year 25 budget that comes. But Margaret Olson, our county attorney, has prepped us with the fact that this case has gone into the indigent level, and we will be putting this bill as a county taxpayer, and that's true, and it's unfortunate. But I think there is a belief in that. In that legal environment, that when we have a case like this that's so high profile, we need to have not only we have the best prosecutors, but we need the best defense as well. This person needs to be represented. We don't want to try this case more than one time. And so we're obviously going to pay a significant amount of money to do that.
Exactly, because you don't want that coming back on appeal that she didn't get a good defense.
Precisely right.
Mm. What's the latest with the 200 South potential closure? It's not on this week's agenda.
We have in between the last meeting where it was decided that a crash gate was the direction that the council wanted to go towards. We did meet with many of the residents and property owners in that area just to make sure there were not any unintended consequences of such an action. We have it on the agenda, I believe, in August. We do, if you are going to close or alter a road like that, you do need to notice it with a certain period of time. So we couldn't bring it back immediately. And we are still probably going to talk one more time, perhaps as a council and maybe a work session, about making sure that that direction is solid. We've asked Dave Thomas from the legal department to look at any unintended consequences from a legal perspective of closing that road to traffic, especially construction traffic on the Wasatch County side. Mm.
So any threat of a lawsuit here? I mean, if you should close it?
I would say that that's a concern I have. I haven't heard anyone say, we will sue you if you do X, Y, or Z. That's a concern that I have, that we are limiting or changing access. Anytime we do that, we want to make sure that everybody can access their property, especially if they've done so traditionally. This is the old Camas Highway, as it's sometimes called. So there has been a road here for some time. But as we've looked at the area, we believe that there are other ways that folks in both Wasatch County and Summit County can access their property, even if this road is closed off. But we still have a little bit of work to do there on that, but we should be prepared to discuss that more probably the very beginning of August.
Yeah, so is the county looking for more concessions by the developer of Wakara and then also Toohey's Homeowners Association?
Well, I think both of those developers have been very open to they actually wanted to pave this road, and in doing so, they're very open to doing whatever they can do financially to mitigate speeds, even numbers of trucks and traffic. They've been very open to that. I think the county's response to that is thank you for that. But as we pave that road, that's probably only going to encourage more traffic. And while that would mitigate dust, are there other ways that we can mitigate dust by not paving the road? How does this road benefit Summit County residents? I think it's the key question that we've been asking as an organization and as a council is how does this benefit county residents, and is it just a detriment to them at the benefit of those on the Wasatch County side.
Okay, so with the offer to pave and maintain the road, Summit County at this point is thank you but no thanks?
That's exactly right. Thank you but no thank you, but we're still keeping that as an option down the road.
All right. Just going to break in here. We did hear from Summit County Chief Deputy Casey Bates, who confirmed that it was a wrong-way driver there on US 40, which crashed into the police car. That police car may have had an alert about the wrong way driver. We don't know that yet, but we'll follow up. Let's see. Now, taking a look at the agenda, a short discussion regarding the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources proposed land acquisition at the East Canyon Wildlife Management Area. Is this part of the 910 Ranch? I mean, we're talking about, I think, less than 3 acres in Summit County.
That's correct. It is completely separate from the 910, but seems like a really exciting opportunity for the state parks and wildlife resources to manage this. I think it's more than 2,000 acres. Only 2.67 of that acres is in Summit County. So they're probably more or less checking a box in that they have to notify us because some of that property is in Summit County. But it's also going to be exciting to hear what the opportunities are. I think a third of that will be managed by state parks for camping and other uses, and then maybe two-thirds of that will be managed by wildlife resources for just wildlife management. So it seems like an exciting acquisition, and excited to hear about it.
Whose property is it?
I believe it was in private hands. I think the cost I saw was $18.5 million. I think $5 million was coming from state parks, $5 million was coming from the wildlife resources budgets, and then I think the legislature appropriated another $8.5 million for the purchase. But again, we don't know much about it. It hasn't been much. 2.67 acres of it in Summit County, so we're haven't heard much about it. They haven't been coordinating with us, as far as I know.
All right, and just kind of looking at the staff report, I mean, it shows big game habitat and future recreation opportunities. So does that mean hunting opportunities?
I'm not sure about hunting, but to me what that means is that the state parks, I know they're going to do campgrounds in some of it, and that's the part that state parks will manage. There's going to be campgrounds and some recreation there, I would assume, if that's appropriate, some fishing. But it didn't feel like hunting from what I read, but I don't think I saw hunting, yes or no.
Okay. Council, I'll get a preview of the Summit County Fair. That's happening the first week of August. Are we all set here?
Yes, August 3rd through the 10th, we're very excited. We have had a couple of challenges with just some work we're doing out there. We're laying some new sod that probably shouldn't have thousands of people trampling on it. So we have some little workarounds there, but we'll hear from that from Tyler and then get some see how involved we can get the council in some of those events and their participation. So I'm excited to hear about preparations for the fair, but I think from my understanding it's been good so far.
Yeah, so any improvements that you can report on? I know some of the money from the transient room tax was being diverted to the Summit County Fair effort.
Well, some of the details of what's gone on out there is changing some grass, we're changing around some things. I think this year we might have to move some of our events off of where they've been traditionally, so there might be some growing pains this year from the work that's gone out there, but hopefully that'll be just a 1-year blip, and I think they've decided some workarounds that should work for everybody.
Okay, and happening at about 4:15, a continued discussion and possible approval to the code as it relates to e-bikes on Basin Recreation Trails. So what's the recommendation here to allow them, similar to what Park City does for those with a mobility discount or 65 and over?
That's correct. I think we're mirroring what Park City has done with trails. It will allow e-bikes on most trails. Of course, this is Basin Rec. This came to us a couple weeks ago, and the council didn't feel ready to make this decision yet. So we've asked Basin Rec to come back in kind of a work session with some possible action. You mentioned that I think the e-bikes will be allowed, but the Class 1 e-bikes would be allowed with those with mobility issues and those that are 65 and over. So I think we're ready to discuss this. We won't be having a public hearing, but the public comment may be taken. And I think Basin Rec has conducted a public hearing, as is Park City. So we've got a lot of the feedback that we received in both those public hearings and the survey in the packet. And so I think we've heard from the public, and we're probably ready to take some action here tomorrow.
Okay. And again, we're specifically talking, I think, about single track trail, because e-bikes are already allowed on the paved pathways, correct? All right.
Yes.
Let's see, at about 4:45, discussion and ratification of the 2024 certified tax rates. The assessor's office presenting this. How much do we have in property valuation in Summit County now? It looked like it was like $50 billion or something?
That sounds right, and I probably don't know off the top of my head. Obviously, this is an action we take every year to set those certified tax rates. As values go up in our county, the tax rate must be adjusted so we do not take in more revenue than we did the previous year unless we go through the truth and taxation process. So as you looked at, I think maybe it was page 3 or 4 of the packet, it had all the different tax rates and how much of those have gone up over the last year. Obviously, those that we went through truth and taxation for, which was service area 6, assessing and collecting, those have gone up in a certain percentage, and most of the other ones have stayed flat or just around 0 to 2%.
Yeah. So it looks like values may have gone down just a tad, so that would mean that the tax rate goes up?
It would do that. That's how it should fluctuate to keep the revenues flat. As tax values go up, tax rates come down, and as values come down, tax rates go up. I guess the caveat there is values rarely go down. But I'm I've had some conversations with our finance director and Cindy about that particular page. I'm excited to hear about those valuations and how we got here.
Yeah. So can that tax rate be manipulated to some extent? I mean, or the valuation, I guess, which would affect then the tax rate. I mean, if the county needed a bit more money, could it then basically decrease the valuation and collect money from a higher tax rate?
No, we'd have to go through truth in taxation even to change it off of what the certified tax rate is. When the auditor sets a certified tax rate, that's given to us. It's given to each municipality in the county as well. And if they don't want to take that very rate, they'd have to go through a truth in taxation process.
All right. Let's see. The council will also discuss and possibly approve a open fire ban for the upcoming July 24th holiday. Is this just for fireworks and just for the 3 days before and the 3 days after the holiday?
I think that's correct. And I think that our emergency management team has been watching not only the temperatures, but the climate and what's happened with Rocky Mountain Power on their wildfire power outage assessments. And that's going to be the recommendation, is that we ban fireworks on the 24th. We were okay on the 4th and had some cooler temperatures, but that's going to be the recommendation. So I'm not sure how often that happens in Summit County, if that's happened in years past, but it might be a poorly received outcome for some people. But I think we're seeing some record temperatures, maybe even today. So it sounds like it's a safety first precautionary recommendation. We're anxious to hear from Catherine and Bryce.
Okay. And again, so it's specific about saying for the July 24th holiday. What about going in the future? Does that mean that, you know, campfires are also banned, open fires in somebody's, you know, backyard chimney or something like that? Are those also banned?
I don't think those are banned. I think this is specific to fireworks. I believe that it's just the problems we have, the problems we encounter around the 4th of July and around the 24th of July because of fireworks are just so pronounced. Obviously, campfires are a concern, and there can be no burns. But I think what we're assessing today is simply fireworks around the 24th of July because of the current conditions.
Okay. Anything else? Are you moving yet out there?
The only other thing I had was we do have our nonprofit grant applications are open. So if any nonprofits would like to put in for the nonprofit grant, it's open through July 31st. I think there's just about $100,000 in there that the county allocates to nonprofits. So please get your applications in.
All right. Summit County Manager Shane Scott, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
Law enforcement officers and technicians with the Utah Division of Wildlife Resources and other agencies had a busy 4th of July weekend inspecting and decontaminating boats of quagga mussels, according to the state. On the phone to tell us why, I have Bruce Johnson. He is DWR's Aquatic Invasive Species Lieutenant. Good morning, Bruce. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you today?
Doing great, thanks. So that seems like a lot of time and resources to track down quagga-carrying boats. Maybe first start by just telling us, what are quagga mussels and why all of this effort to look for them?
Yeah, quagga mussels are an incredibly invasive and adaptive bivalve mussel that was transported here into North America in the early and mid-1980s from the Baltic region. They came over on container ships that deposited water into the Great Lakes that had villagers, which is the juvenile form of the mussels. It's a microscopic worm, I guess, is probably the best description. And they were then transported across the country by sport boats, anglers, and now we have them on our doorstep at Lake Powell, Lake Mead, Lake Havasu, and they're so invasive, they will filter feed through the water and remove all the nutrients and then disrupt the ecosystem, the fisheries, and then beyond that, they'll plug off water systems. They will develop and grow so much that they will close off the water intakes of boats, motors, and then they will continue through the infrastructure of dams, irrigation canals, water treatment facilities. And so they are incredibly destructive to the entire water system.
So at this point, we only have them in Lake Powell in the state of Utah?
Correct.
All right. So how does this work? Actually, I was going to ask, are these mussels you can't eat then, huh? I mean, it sounds like they're not good for anything.
No, they're small. They, even their adult stage, they're maybe as big as your fingernail and your pinky finger. And so they're not big enough to really produce anything valuable in that way. They filter feed through that water, and that's about as their value in the world.
Mm. So it sounds like it was a really busy weekend. I mean, we had the state had put up some 40 inspection stations all over the state. So were all boats stopped and checked?
Yeah, the law requires that if we have an operational inspection station, that all watercraft are required to pull in and let us take a look. And the reason we do that is specifically to make sure that those boaters aren't transporting water with villagers or live adult mussels that can reproduce. And we have actually intercepted several boats in the state over the last few years that have live adult mussels coming from other states on those boats that are ready to launch into our water bodies. And biologically, even a liter of water, as little as a liter of water, can hold 5,000 villagers. And it only takes two of them to be deposited in a water and then close enough to reproduce. So that's why we have those stations across the state. They are along the roadsides. They are at ports of entry. They are located at the boat ramps at some of our state parks and reservoirs. So if you see our staff, please pull in. And that includes all hand-launched watercraft, canoes, kayaks, paddleboards.
Okay. So what is it that you're looking for? I mean, if they're like microscopic here, I mean, do you pull up microscopes?
Well, our message for the last 10 or 12 years has been clean, drain, and dry. We ask boaters to make sure when they leave wherever they're at recreating that they clean their boat, drain by pulling all the drain plugs, and then allow it to dry. And this time of year, it's 7 days for most watercraft. However, even the wakeboard boats, complex boats that have internal water systems, require a 30-day dry time because they have so much capacity internally that may not be able to dry adequately in those 7 days. So we ask that they do clean, drain, and dry, and then we make sure that there's no water on board that watercraft. And if there is, and there's a threat potential, we have the equipment to decontaminate that boat professionally through hot water and time duration with exposure to make sure that we're killing any threat on that watercraft.
So hot water would take care of it. You don't need any kind of pesticide or anything like that, huh?
No, that's been the advantage to our system and all the Western states. We all combine and agree that it takes a certain temperature of water for a certain duration and through the systems a certain way. And that's why all of our staff that you see at our inspection stations have been through a 2-day training that shows them the different kinds of boats, the different access points and fittings to make sure that we are doing the job professionally to the level that we can assure we're taking care of that threat.
So did you find any mussels?
No, but we did intercept a couple of watercraft that were launching into water bodies here in northern Utah that had been at Lake Powell within 7 days and had not received a decontamination. So those are the boats that we really worry about that are traveling back and forth in between the weekends and the summer and depositing either through their bilge pumps or the draining of ballast tanks, and that really scares us.
All right. So how would you know that if a boat had already been inspected? I mean, do they get some kind of certificate, some sticker or something?
Yes. When watercraft come through our inspection stations, our staff do an inspection. They document the boat. They will put a seal on that boat, a wire seal and a clip that is attached and not to be removed until they get to the next water body. And it's entered into a database, so we're aware of where that boat has been. And especially with rentals and family boats, family members, people who are in a boat, don't always know the history of that watercraft. And so it could have been in Lake Powell last week, and, you know, I may not know that my family member had it there, and I'm just taking it to a Jordanelle or a Deer Creek, and unknowingly, I may be transporting villagers or mussels.
All right. So the state legislature now also requiring that boat owners have to take this mussel aware course. Is it something that's free and done online, or how long does it take? What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that we've had an education course in place for several years now, but now it's become mandatory. So anybody who launches or operates any kind of watercraft in Utah is required to take the Mussel Aware course. It is educational. It keeps the boaters aware of what they need to be doing on their part. It takes about 15 to 20 minutes. It's relatively easy. It is free for all the hand-launched non-motorized crafts. So kayaks, canoes, paddleboards, it is free. You just have to be able to provide that proof that you've taken that course. You can print that and keep a copy with you on the craft or on your phone potentially. For motorized boats, they take that same course and then they pay the $20 fee and receive a decal that they display on their boat, similar to registration. The fee is not new. That fee has been in place for 8 or 9 years now, and it was originally paid to the DMV through boat registration, but we were required to change how that fee payment took place 2 years ago, and so now that's why the boaters are seeing that fee assessed directly to us instead of to the DMV.
All right. So of these more than 18,000 boats that were inspected over the long holiday, it sounds like 160 citations and warnings were issued. Who would get the warning versus getting a citation?
That is totally dependent upon the circumstance with the watercraft, the people that we're dealing with, the history of that watercraft and that person. So it is very dependent.
All right. And what? How much does a citation cost?
The citations in the AIS scope of work range from an infraction up to a Class A misdemeanor. So it can be extremely small and then potentially up to $600 or $700.
All right. And again, you can get a citation just by not pulling over, huh? If you've got that that paddleboard or kayak sitting on, you know, on the roof of your car.
Correct. Yes. It is unlawful to bypass our inspection stations when you are transporting a watercraft. And we have pulled those vehicles over and issued citations.
Okay. Anything else you think people ought to know?
Take the time to go to stdofthesea.utah.gov. That site has all the answers to the AIS questions that people may have. That's also where they will find the Muscle Aware course and any other questions they may have about that, and contact numbers for our staff located across the state.
All right. Bruce Johnson is the Aquatic Invasive Species Lieutenant for the Division of Wildlife Resources. Thanks so much for your time, Bruce.
Thank you.
Well, Rochelle Flynn serves as the Assistant Medical Director for People's Health Clinic, and Malin Sorensen's first day with the clinic was yesterday. They just both joined me now in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Rochelle, you both have the letters PA-C behind your name. What does that stand for?
It stands for Physician Assistant Certified.
Okay, so what does that mean?
We're a mid-level provider. We're similar to a nurse practitioner, not an MD or a DO. So we're providers. We can prescribe, evaluate, diagnose, and that's the type of degree we have, a physician assistant.
Okay, and then how long have you been, Rochelle, with the People's Health Clinic?
I've been affiliated with the clinic for almost 12 years. Yeah, I started as a volunteer. It was the first gig I had when I moved to Park City 12 years ago. My college degree is in Hispanic studies, and so I volunteered as an interpreter at the People's Health Clinic. Then I became a part-time medical assistant, then a full-time medical assistant. I took a hiatus and went to PA school for 2 years, returned in 2017, and I've been a PA there since. I was the clinic coordinator for a couple years and then grew into the assistant medical director position.
Yeah, that's a
long span. It's a long time. I love it there. I keep going back.
Yeah. Well, and Maylin, you have kind of a similar story, yeah?
Yeah. Back in 2020, I started as an AmeriCorps Vista, a volunteer. And then I also did a hiatus and went to PA school for 2 years. And I just started yesterday as the diabetes program director.
Okay. So that's a two-year education.
It is. It's
lots
a master's
of science
degree.
And...
Exactly. Lots of science.
And biology.
Right. Right. It's a year of didactic, so it's a year of being in the classroom, and then a year of what what we call clinical rotations, and that's where we learn in clinic how to practice medicine.
Yeah. Well, you both certainly have the education to work a myriad of probably higher paying jobs. So why the People's Health Clinic for you, Rochelle?
It's so rewarding to be able to practice true medicine that's really outside of the confines and parameters of health insurance companies. It's amazing to be able to help people every day live their healthiest lives. And another reason why I love working at People's Health Clinic is working with volunteers every day is really exciting. They really foster a positive environment. Volunteers are happy to be at work. They're happy to be with patients. They make my job easier. And so I love the environment there too.
So is that your job, kind of just hurting the volunteers?
Our director of operations specializes in, I love your phrase, herding of volunteers. I actually supervise, manage, and lead our group of medical assistants, which recently just grew. So I actually manage more staff than volunteers.
Okay. And then for you, Maylin, your first day yesterday, tell me a little bit about your position as the kind of the diabetes coordinator or manager there.
Yeah, so back in 2020, alongside with Dr. Lining, we established the diabetes program. And that has kind of been going on. And basically, all we do is we meet with our patients, make sure their A1C, which is their average blood sugar over 3 months, is within a goal range. And so we will just have these lifelong connections and relationships with these patients in hopes that they can manage their diabetes. This can be a silent killer. A lot of people don't know they have diabetes, type 2 especially. And so allowing these patients to take control of their health is just really what we want to do, is teach them how to empower themselves and to take control and say, I can beat this and I can become a healthier version of myself. And I'm really excited to work with those patients, because the ones at the People's Health Clinic, they show up and they want to put in the work. They really want to change. And I'm just excited to see all the change that they can do.
Yeah, so change can happen.
Yeah.
What? Diet and exercise, like with many other?
Exactly. Diet and exercise alongside with modern Western medicine, they can always go down. So somebody will generally always have type 2 diabetes once they have it, but it can go into what we call remission, and they are able to take control of their health and go back to a completely normal lifestyle if they're willing to make the changes.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of drug improvements, I guess, or, you know, I don't know. I think that the jury's still out on that with the Ozempics and things mm-hmm. like that. That's really expensive medicine. Is it something that the clinic would
yeah.
use?
Where it was my first day, I'm going to turn this over to Rochelle. She knows a little bit more than I do.
I'm happy to help respond to that. So our patients that we serve do not have health insurance. We offer health care to people who are uninsured in Summit and Wasatch counties. So you're right, it's often a challenge to procure current, recent medications because those can be expensive. So we utilize a couple of different resources. And one resource we utilize is taking advantage of programs that the pharmaceutical companies themselves offer to underserved populations, which means you can access free medication if you qualify according to the program's parameters. It often means you have to be below a certain income and you have to not have health insurance. So specifically Ozempic, we do have access to some of it if you qualify. And there's also a lot of other similar medications, weight loss injectable drugs out there that we can also try to access for our patients.
Okay. I think July was a big month for the People's Health Clinic. Maybe you can just give us a little bit of background on the grant that you received.
Sure.
But you started by extending your evening hours three times a week?
We did. Huge news to share with the community. So we were fortunate enough to receive an award from the Mackenzie Scott Foundation, which was $1 million. With that money, we decided to do two things. Expand our hours, which means expand access to the health clinic for our patients, and increase our staff. Welcome, Maylin.
Okay, so your position is being funded by that.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And then the hours, what are
yes.
we talking about?
So in June, so for the previous to July, we were open Monday through Friday till 5, except for Tuesday we're open till 8. Now we are going to increase our hours by opening two additional evenings a week. So we'll be open Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays until 8 o'clock.
Which is really helpful for people.
We hope so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we conducted a survey of patient needs last year, and we discovered through the survey that increasing access by expanding hours into the evenings would be helpful for our patients, so we're trying to respond to that need.
Yeah, so are you able then to find the practitioners that you need then to stay those longer hours?
It's always a balance for sure, because now we'll be open about 55 hours a week. Maylin will be a huge benefit as a staff provider. I'll actually be working in evening also, and our chief medical officer will also be working in evening. And then our fourth paid provider, Dr. Tristan Lubina, currently staffs Tuesdays. We will also depend on volunteer providers to increase access to care. And so, yes, we'll be doing both, staffing the evening clinics with staff and volunteer providers.
Yeah, Maylin, I want to ask you the same question I asked Rochelle. I mean, again, you could go out and find a job pretty much anywhere. So why People's Health Clinic?
You know, I honestly didn't think I could land my dream job right out of school. The People's Health Clinic is so unique, and I like to say it's the happiest place on earth. There is just something, you hear the most gut-wrenching stories from some of our patients. They have not lived the easiest lives. But there's just something about being that person that they can confide in, and that you know that you can help if you just take the time to listen and help change their world. It's something that you can't do in other clinics. This is a clinic unlike any clinic I've ever been in before. I have time to curate these relationships with the patients and just really feel that I can invest in their health, and it's not dictated by insurance or how many patients I have to see a day. It's you're in front of me and what can I do to help you? And that's just something I will never take for granted.
Yeah. Are you bilingual as well?
I am, yes.
Yeah, which helps a lot.
It does.
For both folks. Hey, I also wanted to mention, Rochelle, I note that you last year were awarded the Humanitarian PA of the Year. This was by the Utah Academy of Physician Assistants, so congratulations. Did somebody nominate you for that?
Thank you. Yes, our CEO, Dr. Mari Lining, nominated me. It's an honor.
Yeah. So, I mean, just recognition, a plaque, and...
Yes, correct. Yeah, the Utah Academy of PAs awards 4 awards every year, and the Humanitarian Award is one of them. And I'm honored, and it is a pleasure to continue to serve our community.
All right. Yeah. Mari also told me that you had published your first case report on leprosy in a national journal. I mean, is that still a thing, leprosy?
It's still a thing. It's crazy. Yes, so it is a bacterial disease. And we, once it's diagnosed, the difficult part is diagnosing it because, like you implied, it's not really in the forefront of everyone's minds. It takes multiple skin biopsies, consultations with specialists. We have to send the sample to a lab. And once the diagnosis is made, it's 2 years of antibiotics, which is a long time, but it's a treatable disease, which is the great thing about it. So I published my article with the hope and the goal to remind PAs out there in the world that bacterial disorders need to be considered when you're seeing patients. And I hope that reminding people of about infectious diseases that are still prevalent will be helpful for my colleagues.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly have never seen somebody with leprosy, but I mean, it's a skin disorder,
yes,
yeah? So
right.
the bacteria causes what?
Yeah,
boils or just lesions?
Lesions is the best way to describe it because it presents in a variety of different ways, which is why it's so difficult to diagnose. It also affects your nerves. So interestingly, not only do you present with skin lesions, but you present with numbness, tingling, pain, something similar to a shingles infection. And the combination of odd symptoms guided us into the direction of infectious diseases. And we did a skin biopsy and found the bacteria, identified it.
Where does the bacteria come from? Do we know?
It's transmitted in two different ways, with respiratory sputum, so you could cough onto somebody. Or if you come in contact with armadillo meat. And that's pretty uncommon in Utah. But some areas hunt and eat armadillos, and armadillos are actually the main way that disease is spread in the United States. It can stay in your system for like 10 years before it even presents with symptoms, so it's really hard to identify where it came from. And 95% of the human population is naturally immune. We're not really quite sure why, but it's pretty hard to catch.
Yeah, so the published case then, I mean, what was it that you had discovered, or I mean, was it new information as part of that report?
The report was a case study. It wasn't new information, but rather, I tried to make people aware and to present an interesting presentation of a disease so that everyone could see how it could present.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Rochelle or Maylin, anything else you want to add?
No, thanks so much talking to us today, Leslie.
All right, well, congratulations on the new gig, Maylin.
Thank you so much.
Well, Utah's Olympic Bid Committee wants Utahns to celebrate the early morning of July 24th when the state is expected to be awarded the 2034 Olympic Games. KPCW's Christine Weller has more on that.
Utah's bid committee purposely asked to give its final bid presentation to the International Olympic Committee on July 24th. So if the state is awarded the 2034 Games, celebrations can coincide with Pioneer Day festivities. The presentation is set for 11 a.m. Paris time, which is 3 a.m. in Utah. Still, the bid committee is asking Utahns to gather for an overnight watch party to hear the presentation and the IOC's decision live. Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall said the watch party will be at City Hall on Washington Square, where many will be setting out chairs for the annual Days of 47 parade starting at 9 a.m.
Some of you might remember the iconic celebrations that happened right here in 1995 when we were chosen to host the 2002 Winter Games. We are building upon that legacy, and I want to hear all of your cheers from Washington Square in Paris on July 24th when they vote yes.
The overnight event, known as Celebrate 2034, starts July 23rd with video boards broadcasting events and early news reports from Paris between 5 p.m. and 11 p.m. The IOC is expected to award Utah the 2034 Games around 4 a.m. Mountain Time. Mendenhall said there will be food trucks serving breakfast and caffeine to thank Utahns for joining. The Park City area will hold a celebration of its own later in the day. It's scheduled from 4 to 9 p.m. at the Utah Olympic Park. There will be vendors, food, activities, giveaways, and an athlete meet and greet from 4 to 6 p.m. Christine Weller, KPCW News.